You're listening to Talking Taiwan with your host, Felicia Lin.
On April 3rd, 2024, an earthquake that's been reported as measuring 7.2 and 7.4 hit Hualien, which is located on the east coast of Taiwan. It was 7:58 a.m. local time. The last major earthquake of similar magnitude was 25 years ago on September 21st, 1999 in Nantou, which is located in central Taiwan. The earthquake, also referred to as the 921 earthquake, killed over 2,400 people and left over 100,000 people homeless. In this episode, I'm bringing back one of our previous guests onto this podcast, T.A. Shi, who I interviewed about civil defense in Taiwan. In that interview, T.H. mentioned that it was his first-hand experience with the 921 earthquake that made him concerned about disaster preparedness and civil defense. I asked T.H. to share his recollection of the 921 earthquake and his thoughts on how Taiwan's disaster response has improved since then. By most reports, the death toll from the Hualien earthquake was around 13 at the time of this interview.
Welcome to the podcast, T.H.
Well, it's good to be here again, right? After the big earthquake, again.
Yes, I know. Definitely, this is a good reason to have you back. And you're one of the first people that I thought about because I know that you went through the 1999 earthquake in Nantou. And so I wanted to have you on to share your thoughts. How have you been doing since the earthquake? Where were you on April 3rd?
I think I was on my bed. Sorry, it was like 7:59 a.m. in the morning. So I was on my bed. Well, the quake was a little bit bigger than I've expected. But yes, I was sleeping, right? Basically, yes.
I wanted to ask you about the September 21st, 1999 earthquake, because I know you had some first-hand experience. And could you paint the picture and describe what the situation was like?
I think that was in 1999, and I was it happened at 1:47 a.m. Mm-hmm. I was sleeping again at that time. But I was in Kaohsiung, yes, which is the southern big port city. I was serving in the Navy as a conscript. Mm-hmm. I was aboard a ship, right? I was there, right? But I felt the quake immediately, and everybody felt that. So it was really big, and we immediately know that there must be something very wrong about, because you're afloat, right? You're afloat, and you feel that kind of quake. You know, well, that must be something big happened, right? So we just turn on the TV, because on the ship we have a TV, right? So it's all like the news or sending out like warning messages, like there just big earthquake happened in Nantou, but we weren't so sure about the epicenter, everything else. So it's a bit like, you know, something big just happened. You couldn't get information out of a good, correct information out of what actually happens, because everybody was in a state of panic, literally. So that was a very hard night, because it was 1:47 a.m. I had to wait like 4 hours to the morning to get a message out of a public TV channels, because that was where my hometown was located. It was in Nantou, right?
You were able to actually go there, right? You had to take some leave, and you were able to go back to Nantou, because I'm sure you're very concerned because you have family there.
Yeah, because on the first day, because the military asked whether you are coming from Nantou, because they have a database of us, know where we are from. So they said, would you like to go home? Or can you safely reach your home at that time? So for me, I waited for 2 days. So I went back to Puli the third day, right? Not the first day of the event. But I couldn't get in touch with my family back in Nantou. My father, and we were in the military. Well, in the Navy, you couldn't just make free calls. And in 1999, you didn't have mobile phones. You didn't have smartphones. You have to use public phones to make every call, right? And you got only like 1 minute of air time to talk to your family. You couldn't get in touch with them. So I called a few relatives in Taipei, and they had some information for me, said that my father, my dad has already dashed down to Nantou with him, his mini trucks with a lot of support relief packages, right? Because it's a mini truck. He could carry a lot of loads of supplies back to Nantou. And my mother was fairly okay in Taipei. So kind of my sister and brothers were all in Taipei. So Taipei wasn't badly affected. So it was such a great relief. So I decided to, first, I need to go back to Taipei. But the tram, it stopped operation. No tram. I was young, so of course I couldn't afford a car. So I borrowed a motorbike from one of my friends in Kaohsiung and rode it all the way back to Taipei, which took me, because you couldn't get any information, traffic information, because some, you know, there are hundreds of bridges collapsed. But I had the experience of navigating Taiwan using paper maps. It's like I was like a motorcycle traveler, so I know how to navigate the terrain without, you know. Yes. And ask people whether the bridges are still open or not. And I managed to get back to Taipei and get some supplies and call a few of my like a motorbike friends riding dirt bikes. Yeah, because that's the right type of a transportation where which could get you into Nantou. Yes. It's not that little scooter you see everywhere in Taiwan. that was like that. Yes. It took me almost 1 day from Kaohsiung to Taipei. Yeah, and then took another day from Taipei to Nantou, which usually will take you around, you know, 4 to 5 hours if you drive fast or ride fast. But it took me like 4 to 5 times, which is considerably fast enough.
So what was it like when you arrived? What did you see?
So when I reached there, because it was like, it's very chaotic. What I mean by chaotic, you see people camping on the street. You see, a lot of building collapsed, damaged, because for Puli, because it was the biggest town closest to the epicenter of that quake. So of Puli, we had around like 80,000 residents at that time. Around 5,000 building collapsed immediately. And another 5,000 building badly damaged. So you are seeing like 10,000 buildings, rubbles and shacks all over there. So it's really like watching a movie. Yeah. So I'll say it was a shock for everyone. Shock for everyone. Yes. And you saw people. Yes, this is total chaos. It's a total chaos. Yes. Third day, it was still chaos, yes.
You said that your immediate family, your brothers and sisters, your mom and dad were in Taipei and they were safe, but did you have any extended family in Puli?
Yes, that's where all my, like, you know, cousins, uncles, they were living in Puli, yes. Yes.
Were you able to get in touch with them when you arrived there?
Puli is it's a basin. So if you're like most of my relatives, they were living in Puli, and some were living like in like the mountainous areas, like Lushan, Qingjin Farm, the hot spring there. They couldn't get down to the basin for more than a month. Yeah, more than a month. So the military had to like airdrop a lot of supplies to those affected areas in Nantou. So we saw a lot of helicopters coming in, coming out, because Puli was considered a command post for rescue workers in the region. And a lot of Nantou is the only county that's not close to the Spied Sea. So it really take you see a lot of rescue workers there. because people, even though people in the urban areas like Taichung, they had more resources out there available to them. What in Nantou, it's not. People live in remote areas. Their villages had been cut of electricity and waters and everything, communications. So only on the day that I arrived in Puli, which was the first day after the quake, well, the president issued a state of emergency. That was the first day. Because probably Li Denghui at that time, he saw that, oh, damn, we really need to use a state of emergency. Otherwise, you know, the tragedy will continue to unfold even more due to, you know, the government and most of the government agency, they haven't been through this kind of level of disasters, so they couldn't respond in time. So there need to be a very powerful commander and a command structure, which is all supported by the declaration of a state of emergency. So that helped a lot. After the fourth day.
Did you have first aid or rescue training? And what did you do when you were there? How did you help the efforts?
I think for me, because I was already in the military, so I couldn't actually volunteer for any of the search and rescue works. Yes, because I was a conscript. So what we did, the young people living in that town, around my villages, 2 to 3 villages, we basically set up a volunteer guard team to patrol the neighborhood at night, because there will be some real refugees coming in, or some people who just want to harass the neighbors to get maybe out of they couldn't get food, right? Some people just want to steal money or harass people, right? There could be some violence out there. So because these young people were from the same villages, or just villages across the river. So we basically formed a night patrol team to guard our community. And that's the first thing we do, because we saw the need in this. And the second, because we are light on vehicles, I had 2 dirt bikes at that time. And some of us had trucks, mini trucks. So we try to support very light logistics between the communities. That's the second thing we do. The third thing we do, because there are a lot of volunteer groups coming into Puli, and they don't know how to navigate the town because it was badly damaged. So we support the command post out there by order from the government, basically lead the way, try to show them, oh, this is the village, this is the right way you should take. And if you you probably need some kind of support if you really want to go to that village. So that's some of the things we do for a whole week. Yes. Getting people into the town, like volunteer groups, and getting them out of the town by leading the way. So I didn't do any rescue, search and rescue, because I wasn't really trained for that kind of stuff. And it's in the mountains. Mm-hmm. So I had some training on saving people from open waters, like rivers and oceans. But it was a different kind of a disaster. So I really couldn't help on that regard.
And I've been hearing that for the Hualien earthquake, most of the death was actually caused by nature, like mudslides and things. It wasn't actually from building collapse. But what about in the case of Puli? Because, 10,000 buildings damaged, that's like quite a significant number.
That's quite a big number, significant. Yeah, it's very significant.
So what do you think do you think that was the main factor that led to the high death toll in the case of the 1999 earthquake?
Well, definitely, because in 1999, the epicenter was pretty much, it's not far from a major big city, which is Taichung, right? So, this time in Hualien, the epicenter was off the coast by 20 kilometers. So that's really a big factor. And Taichung was really populous compared to Hualien, which is like a big
Yeah, that's another thing I want to bring up, like the population and the terrain. Like if we compare Puli and
the terrain, the population density plays an important part in this. So I would say that we've been lucky. The epicenter, because Hualien, there are several fault lines in Hualien, so they had that kind of experience all year long. But this time it was much bigger, but you know it was less populated. It was way less populated.
Right.
Yes,
right,
in Hualien and Taidong.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So there were seeing few casualties, way few casualties compared to 1999. But we see a lot of damage to the mountain areas, a lot.
Were there a lot of aftershocks in 99?
Oh, within a month, we had around 10,000 aftershocks.
Oh, 10,000, really?
Yeah, and around 400 of that, more than 400 of that was, how should I say that, palpable. You could feel that, more than 400.
Wow.
Every day you have to endure like 10 big quakes. Yes.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yes. So
really?
so that's why people had to camp outside. You just don't know when the next quake will come. It's not safe at all. It could probably destroy your building more. And there with that kind of frequency. In Nantou, that's why we need a patrol team around the neighborhood. Well, people were all camping outside. Even those rescue workers like Tsuji Foundation, which is the biggest Buddhist group there, they had to camp outside as well. You know, the building, the public schools in Puli, we had around maybe 20 of them. All of the buildings were collapsed, destroyed.
Wow, what an experience, my goodness.
Yeah, so that was, it was the police station. Well, the building was collapsed. Fire department, the building collapsed.
Yeah, so there has to be significant reconstruction. Like probably a lot of the buildings, did they have to be demolished and rebuilt?
Rebuilt, redesigned, demolished. Yes, yes. It took more than 3 years. So for those like schools, they had to students, they had to relocate to some other areas to continue their education. For 3 years.
Wow. And when they relocated, does that mean they had to go somewhere quite far to another village or town or something?
No, it's still in Puli, but it's like a temporary school. It's like a sheltering school.
Or yes, some other building that they would use for the school. It's not originally a school, right?
No. So that was the case. Yeah. It was very bad. It was really bad. So I think a lot of people had that kind of a traumatic experience. So when people in Puli... Like my friends, they felt the quake this time in Hualien. It brings back all the bad memories.
Yeah, I did have a question, like how to deal with trauma. Did you experience some trauma yourself having to deal with the 1999 earthquake?
I think for me, because even though I've witnessed like 3 deaths. My neighbors on the left, well, they were building collapse, so they were there. All right. For me, I used to volunteer as a lifeguard, so I wouldn't say I had the training, but I've witnessed casualties more often than most of other people. So I had a better recovery, like psychological recovery, that kind of a sense.
How long did you stay in Puli after the quake to help out?
A week.
Just
a week. For me, just a week, because I had.
Yeah, you probably can't take that time off either, yeah, right? Because you're still in the military.
But because the state of emergency announced, so the government resource started to pull in. So it's getting more stable. It's not like the first 3 to 4 days, it was total chaos.
What do you think are some of the lessons from the 921 earthquake?
I think for Taiwan, there are a lot of lessons learned from the 921 earthquake. The building codes, you know, everybody talk about that, the building codes. It was most of the buildings, they were built not to withstand that kind of natural disaster. So it changed a lot. And the biggest part of that, similar to the 911 in the U.S., the attack in 2001, 9/11. So it changed a lot of things. Like in the U.S., it probably start, you have a federal agency like FEMA. And here in Taiwan, because disaster, there are some existing laws that there are so many spaces to fill in. So people started thinking about, we need a dedicated agency. We need a give the firefighters or some of the rest first response team more resource. So there are a lot of new laws coming in because of that tragic experience. For example, in any natural disaster, the local government, the responsibility between local government, volunteer groups, and the central government and the military, it is much better defined in the new law. It wasn't defined at all. So that's why a state of emergency has had to be declared. But after that, it was much more refined. So in any natural disaster, there's a escalation procedures, which is pretty, most of the local government or down to the town level, they really know how to respond in like smaller accident or natural disasters or even like man-made disaster. That was a pretty big reform. And it took maybe another few years to get the bureaucracy used to it, because even for government staff, they had to have some kind of training.
And now for a short break. Talking Taiwan is the longest-running Taiwan-related podcast and a Golden Crane Award winner. And our two-person team is committed to continuing to producing meaningful content for you. As an independently produced podcast, we want to take a moment to thank all of our listeners and donors for your support. You make our work possible. Talking Taiwan has been around for 10 years already, and with your support, we'll be around for 10 more. We have a lot of exciting things in the works that we will be announcing soon. To support our work, you can make a contribution to our GoFundMe campaign or at talkingtaiwan.com/support. Contributions can be made to Talking Taiwan Podcast at gmail.com via PayPal or Zelle. Now, back to our episode.
So then this would have a good impact because Taiwan could experience other natural disasters, right? Like the typhoons or mudslides or different things too. So this could be applied in those other situations also, right?
True. And it, because 1999, the big earthquake, 2009, there's another big typhoon. So we basically learn our lessons every few years. I think Taiwan has improved a lot. And I think the other part is about it's more on the energy security of energy supplies, that level. Because in 1999, we had a power rationing in northern part of Taiwan for 2 weeks, more than 2 weeks.
So, because of the earthquake?
Because of the earthquake, yes. Mm. So was more the Hsinchu Science Park, which is pretty famous for, the home of semiconductors like TSMC. They had to shut down their operation for 5 days. Every company there, they had to shut down operations. Well, the stock market had to be shut down. And so everything had to be shut down. No power rationing, right?
Well, yeah, because the earthquake affected the power in Nantou, right?
Yes, and it basically destroyed the power grid because it wasn't distributed enough to sustain that kind of damage. So after that, the Thai power started to having a better redundant plans or redundancy in their electricity grid. they started building that up till now. They are still doing that. That also proves to be working, yes, in this earthquake.
So what does that mean? It's going to, the power grid will be more resilient in the case of a natural disaster?
Yes, yes, that's basically the, that's basically the case.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like, well, in 1999, you destroy like two power distribution stations, and you could cut down the electricity island-wide. It was the case. Because they only focus on efficiency. So there was like a single point of failure. So if you strike that station, it will probably cut the whole the supply, electricity supply down.
Yeah, I'm also curious because I know that Taiwan sends a lot of humanitarian efforts to other countries. Like when Turkey had the earthquake, they sent people to help and different things like that. Do you think that Taiwan also gains experience dealing with natural disasters from sending these humanitarian efforts?
Yeah, that's also proved to be the case. Like we have Suji is known for sending a lot of humanitarian aid to Turkey, to Syria, to Philippines during their typhoon seasons.
Mm-hmm.
They've learned mm-hmm. that the hard way from Taiwan. So I think for that part, mm-hmm. these NGOs here are rather experienced. They know how to collaborate with the government. They know where their capacity lies in an emergent status. And they know what they shouldn't do. Because there will be in natural disaster for newcomers, they will think, oh, I could just go in those areas and try to save people. Like the case that I saw in Nantou, there were a bunch of medics coming from Taipei.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They forgot to bring their own food. So,
oh, wow.
They thought, okay, I could shop right along the way, go to a supermarket. Yes, but it was, for newcomers, they probably... they couldn't bring their own logistics. Yes. So that probably thing that we should they learned right, it the hard right, way because goodness. They have to literally back the food.
It's a whole wild wild situation. Yeah.
It's pretty wild. And those medics, doctors, they're coming from Taipei.
Yeah.
Taipei wasn't affected that much. So they could buy, they could go to 7-Eleven, grab some food.
Oh, boy.
The ATM, ATM didn't work at all. The bank collapsed. If you don't have cash, you wouldn't survive.
Right. Wow. Those are interesting times. So let's talk about how the response has been now to the earthquake, like now almost 2 weeks in Hualien. What was the response like after the earthquake happened?
I think the first response was pretty good. The government opened the emergency operation center right away. The president was there. The ministry responsible for rescuing efforts. For airlifting those peoples, they respond pretty fast, within an hour. And I know Hualien is also the base, the headquarters of Tsuji Buddhist Foundation. So they're doing a lot of, they respond pretty fast. They issue correct information to the public. And the transportation was the train, right? From Yilan to Hualien was repaired within 1 day. It wouldn't happen like that way in 1999. It wouldn't like that in 1999. So I think you have we had a bit of luck, plus a very responsive government at that time. So that was a first 2 to 3 days. But then we started to find out, oh, there are more damages being done to the mountain areas, to the buildings out there. And even to some of the power stations in Thai Power. So these damages were done by aftershocks. Mm. So even though we responded pretty fast and good, but beware of those aftershocks because it's sometimes the aftershocks would cause more damages than because they were kind of like, oh, we're safe right now. It's totally okay. Just a small minor aftershock, it destroyed a lot of things.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I heard that maybe some people complained that they weren't notified of the earthquake. They didn't get like a text notification in time. And maybe there was some complaint that, well, although I don't know if this is a fair complaint, like the prediction, right? If they were able to predict the earthquake in advance.
I think that there's a those messages were sent out by a system called public warning system, which is a the system is hosted by a agency under National Science Council, so they have to coordinate between different ministries. And for this time, because the earthquake alerts were issued by the Central Weather Agency, and they felt like, because it's an automatic trigger system, they feel like people in Taipei, New Taipei, they estimate based on their previous data model that, well, even though it felt it feels pretty big, but it's not big enough to cause enough damages. So they were not sending, the system were not sending public warning messages to those people in Taipei and New Taipei. But people in Yilan, Hualien, Nantou, they did receive these kind of messages. So I think they...
Do you know how soon they received it?
Well, it depends. For like Hualien, some of the residents, they were receiving that 8 to 10 seconds before the quake. So 8 to 10 seconds, it's pretty sure, but it did save some people. Like we saw the video footage online. A driver was driving the Central Highway Pass, Zhongheng, and when he got the public warning message, he stayed in the tunnel. So he wasn't, his car wasn't, disrupted by the landslides, you know, because you could see the dash cam videos, from dash cam videos. He got the message, he decided to stay in the tunnel.
Wow.
So
okay.
that basically saved his whole family.
There was also a video of nurses bracing and steadying newborns during the earthquake.
Yes. So 8 to 10 seconds is enough to save you in certain scenarios. But if you're building like 20 F, like very high buildings, 20 of you, there's nothing you could go.
I mean, do you think like there's a lot of education about what to do in an earthquake? Is that why people know what to do? Or when they're alerted, does alert advise them what to do or not to do?
For my generation, we're not trained. We had no drills. But for like younger people, they were in school because of enforcement of certain laws. They have to practice the kind of drills every year in schools. So the young people, they are much better trained. They got better awareness because of the reform in the whole awareness education programs. If you are driving in the Central Highway Pass, there will be a lot of signs there saying that if you run into some problem, you should call this. If you get some messages, you should do this. So at the tourist information centers, there are some materials that would teach you or just present how you should respond in a certain crisis.
How do you think the rescue efforts for Hualien compare to... Well, I mean, of course, obviously, it's like not as much damage as Nantou, right?
It's not even comparing apple to orange. It's a person I wouldn't worry about if the earthquake just happened in Hualien and caused damages in Hualien. You got people, you got firefighters from Yilan, Taidong, Kaohsiung to support them to do the search rescue tasks. They were professional. While the Ministry of the Interior also supported a lot of logistics. And the military supported that as well. And Ziji is there. They do provide sheltering, food, everything, psychological comfort, which they're pretty good at that. So they activate their support network within 10 minutes, right away. I say that learning from past experience is very important, yes.
After an earthquake happens, we know that people have to be careful about aftershocks. Do you think there's anything else that people should be expecting? And also, how should they handle it when there's an aftershock?
Well, I think for most people, like us, we'll check the our buildings, right, the houses, because you might see some damages done, not very visible, not collapsing, but there will be some cracks on the wall, right? So you really should check the building or get some professionals to check for you, or even the government here, like in this case in Hualien, you could ask for support from the government because there are some private companies who could do this for you for free because it's supported by the government, it's funded by the government. I think that kind of resource you should seek here in Taiwan, apparently, yes. So during that time, you really should check the security of your building. And I think that's the number one thing, because a good building collapse kills more people than most of other types of damages. And the second thing here in Taiwan, just go don't go to the mountains after a major quake. Just don't go there, right? Aftershocks, it will cause landslides, causing a lot of collapse. It's a deform of the trail. Everything will be, a lot of things will be destroyed. And the government wouldn't rush in to reconstruct those trails because they know there will be more aftershocks. So they will wait for 1 or 2 months to get in. 1999, they couldn't get in, but now they could fly drones to take a look, to observe the damages out there. They would discourage everyone not going there. Yes.
Very interesting. I wanted to ask you about the question, yes, I asked you earlier about how soon people are notified, because,
yes,
you know, interestingly enough, a few days after the Hualien earthquake, there was a very small earthquake in New York. And
the earthquake I'm referring to happened on April 5th in New York City at 10:23 a.m. local time, and it measured 4.8 on the Richter scale.
I was awake around 10 something in the morning, and I could feel it. Not that much. I just felt like that's not the subway. That's more than, because I do live near the subway line. Yeah, and the complaint was that we didn't get a text notification until 20 to 30 minutes after, because I clearly felt it, and then I didn't get a text message until 11 a.m. So it's like, okay, I don't know how prepared we are. Should I be worried about this? I don't know. Exactly. I'm like, okay, well, I already know there was an earthquake.
It didn't help.
So it's kind of funny.
Yeah. But for the case in Taiwan, the government might have invested more than $1 billion on the warning system, but you know, starting from early 2000. So it cut down the warning time. I get 1 minute, 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, all the way to 8 to 10 seconds.
Yeah, incredible.
Beyond that, it's probably not possible given the size of Taiwan, but that's more than enough. That's pretty. It takes a lot of investment. Yes.
So, for people that are living in earthquake prone areas, especially like Taiwan or any other parts of the world that are earthquake prone, do you have some advice on how people should be prepared for an earthquake?
Well, I think there are some general rules to be applied. The first, like me, maybe not paranoid, not that paranoid, but I do have a go-to bag. I do have a flashlight in every room because it could be trapped inside a collapsed building. So I have whistles. I have like a fresh bottle of waters somewhere so I could grab it when the building collapses. I'm trapped there. I think that's the basic thing that you have to do. And it doesn't really cost a lot of money, right? It's just a bottle of water, flashlight, and maybe not radio. Yeah, the whistle. Whistle is very important. Whistle is very important. Yes. Otherwise, it wouldn't have the energy to call for support. The shouting there, yes. Yeah, whistle.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you need someone to know where you are.
So that's the baseline, the basic things you should do, right?
And what should people do and not do during an earthquake or an aftershock? Like, you hear a lot of like conflicting stories, especially the thing about standing in the door. It seems like that's kind of conflicting. Maybe it's like depends on what kind of construction you're in.
Yeah. It really depends on the construction. So there's no single answer, correct answer to that. The best thing is to ask your government to support the right information, correct information. But the government has the responsibility, mm-hmm. yes.
But are there some things in general that people should do or not do during an earthquake? You know, like I heard you should, if you're indoors, stay indoors and make sure you're not close to a window, drop to the ground, you know, different things
that. Yes. That's a general principle would apply. Yes. That's everywhere.
And if you're outdoors, make sure you're not near where something could fall on you or things like that, right?
Yes. I think for most people, that's like basic knowledge. But the problem is that I saw a lot of my friends. They said that they were kind of freezed when the quake hits them. You're panic. So you should really practice that. Don't just stay there. At least you need to do something. Staying there is okay, but you need to be conscious. Probably is another point that I want to add. Don't try to... because people love to chase, naturally, love to watch accidents. What I mean by that is in 1999, we didn't have social media. But now people will just scroll their phones, apps, and try to watch all the videos. That's probably the thing that you shouldn't do after the quake. Yes. Yeah, maybe just report what's going on. But don't just, you know... Because there will be a lot of information coming out of that. And some nice people, not there in the quake, they would intentionally or unintentionally quote videos that's not happening at this earthquake and say, oh, this is what's happened in Taiwan. So, yes, that's one big problem in this century. You see a lot of media, a lot of videos circulating on the internet. But it doesn't. Those videos doesn't help at all. They don't help at all.
Oh, okay. So your point is, if in time of an earthquake, don't go to social media as your source for advice.
Well, I think go to social media is okay. Just that if you think you're safe, just keep calm and carry on. Yes. Don't like watch a drama or scroll all the way and try to retweet all the way because you might be retweeting misinformation. Yes. First, make sure you're safe. Your family is safe. Your beloved ones are safe. And that's more than enough.
Is there anything else you wanted to share or reflect on in terms of what Taiwan has learned or in these 25 years since the 1999 earthquake?
I think, the government of Taiwan, because it used to be a very strong party state system, so they wouldn't allow the previous ruling party, they wouldn't allow the civil society to flourish. But after that, they figured out, it's where the civil society, the capacity lies in. So they were more willing to support, to engage with the civil society, because New Taipei were really affected at their areas. A lot of people donated money. A lot of people volunteered to work on paperworks. Right? There are a lot of paperworks that need to be done after a huge disaster. Right? And there are a lot of things that the civil society could probably provide a better services to those people. So after that, the government started because of the government at that time, they wanted to be very strong and very capable, but they were not up to the bar. So I think the biggest thing the government learns is that, you have a lot of charity organizations there. They care about their neighborhood. They know their neighborhood. And that's also the case because the quake happened in 1999. Change of a government happened in 2000, which was a few months after the quake. I think people had enough. They decided to vote for Chen Shui-bian. I think for 1999, because we were still trapped, and it was only a few years after the lift of martial law. So the government I will say that the civil society was flourishing, the private sector, of course. But with regard to crisis response, Well, the government was still in the hands of just a few people. It's basically that way. So in that kind of a big earthquake, the government couldn't respond in time. They would not have all the capacity to respond timely and accurately. So they would, I think after that, the government decided that we really should let the civil society to flourish, which a lot of mechanism collaborating, like a collaboration, how the government agency should collaborate with civil society. Those part of mechanisms were then encoded in law, like a reform of certain laws. So that was really a big step forward. That's why you see a lot of civil society and private sectors willing to donate to disaster relief. And even TSMC, the wife of the chairperson, the founder, Morris Chang, well, she was there in Hualien, I think the second day, to see if there's anything. TSMC got a foundation. They could help. It wouldn't be that way in 1999. So that's a general sentiment. The actual level, just like being approved by the earthquake at this time in Hualien, people say, oh, it's going to damage TSMC. They weren't able to ship their advanced chips for weeks, but they resumed their capacity, like 80% of their production capacity within one day. So, that level of preparedness is really good, right? In any, you know, anywhere in the world, this is really good, right? So I would say that Taiwan is more resilient than most people would think, but it's still hard to say that whether it's prepared enough. You know, facing with a certain adversary, you just don't know,
TH also spoke about his gym, 4SC CrossFit, where they support and do training and workshops related to disaster preparedness and civil defense.
Well, I think for me, I tend to work on practical steps. So for example, you need to be better trained to respond in any crisis or emergency scenarios. So you need to be fit. You need to know your team. You need to know your neighborhood. You need to know how to navigate without your phone. The kind of things or trainings that they serve dual purpose. Those capacity could be channeled to a natural disaster, right? To support disaster relief, like earthquake, big earthquake this time. That could also, if you have that kind of capacity embedded in the civil society, in the younger generation, they could be better prepared for an invasion scenario. But we do have some expertise in other regards. So we just provide a platform by collaborating with like-minded groups out there to support this kind of training or like mutual understanding. You need to know each other, build trust first, and care about your community, right? So for me, I tend to work on very practical and pragmatic stuff at this stage. Because it's something that you could apply to your life. It's not just an invasion. You do need to protect your family. You know, I do have friends in Hualien, so it's like a wake up call for them again. And for those like younger people, because they only heard about the 1999 earthquake, so we're not born yet, so we couldn't imagine what kind of situation we'll be facing. But for this time, I think it's a wake-up call for a lot of people. Some were there, like they were traveling. So, oh, damn, should I do?
Thank you so much for your support, TH. I really appreciate it and all the work that you're doing.
I've been speaking with TH Shi about the 921 earthquake that hit Nantou in 1999 and how it compares to the April 3rd earthquake in Hualien. For those wishing to donate to Hualien earthquake relief efforts, visit our website talkingtaiwan.com, where we will include links to the Zuchi Foundation and Taiwan's Ministry of Health and Welfare's Public Health and Welfare Foundation for disaster relief. Now it's time for you to show us some love Rate us on Spotify, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Audible, leave us a review there. It helps others to discover Talking Taiwan. To learn more about any of the items mentioned in this episode, visit our website, talkingtaiwan.com. There we'll list any related links. Thank you for listening to another episode of Talking Taiwan. I'm your host, Felicia Lin.
Talking Taiwan is brought to you by Forumosa.com.